Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to WBH Radio, your host William Holly. Thank you for checking out episode number 72. Let me give you the episode rundown. So I reached out to an author by the name of Dave Zirin. I wanted to talk to him about two of his books. One is a biography of the great Jim Brown. The other is his upcoming book, The Kaepernick Effect. So we spoke for about 40 minutes. But I wanted to inject more of myself into the podcast. So what you're going to hear is the first half of our interview. And then it's going to be me flying solo, providing some feedback, commentary. And then the end of the podcast is the second half of our discussion. All right, let's go. Very excited to speak to our next guest. He is the sports editor for The Nation, a weekly magazine, an author, prolific writer. His newest book is coming out September 14th. It's called The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. The one and only Mr. Dave Zirin. Dave, welcome.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for your time. Dave, how many of these books have you written?
I've written 11 books. The Kaepernick Effect is number 11.
Number 11. I'm trying to push out my very first book, and what I'm finding out is it's a lot of lonely days staring at a computer screen trying to figure out the best sentence structure. So if you could just tell us, what does it take to get through one of these?
Yeah, I mean, I say to my wife sometimes, this must be what giving birth feels like, and that makes her very, very mad at me. So I've only said that once. Believe me, I've only said that once. But the similarity is that it's painful, and there's quite the gestation period. So my first book came out in 2005. So I guess that's 11 books in 16 years, and it is lonely. And that's probably easily the hardest part because, you know, I got into this business because I like people, you know what I'm saying? And I like telling people stories. I'm not a novelist. I don't want to sit by myself and come up with stuff out of whole cloth. I want to be talking to people. I want to be interviewing people. I want to be in the mix.
Yes.
And, you know, to be at home by yourself with nobody to face but your computer screen. I mean, that is tough. It's not easy. It's not for the faint of heart. And to be clear, nobody, unless your name is Stephen King, gets rich doing this. I mean, you know, everybody's got to get paid. Publicists, publishers.
Yes.
Everybody, and then a little bit trickles down to the author. So it's not easy. It's not for the faint of heart. But when you're done and you're holding it in your hand, man, there's no feeling quite like it, which I guess also makes it like childbirth.
Sounds great. Sounds great. Well, I look forward to that moment, man. Hopefully I'll get there. Dave, let me tell you in the audience how I discovered your work. I wanted to do my research, you know, because there's a lot of athlete activism going on today in 2021. So I wanted to go back and kind of just read about some of the things that took place. And one of the gentlemen I wanted to study was Jim Brown. I know there was always great reverence paid to him. I remember before a basketball game, LeBron James did sort of like a semi-bow in his direction. And that is when I discovered your biography, Jim Brown, The Last Man Standing. So, Dave, if you can help us understand, why is Jim Brown considered one of those iconic revolutionary athletes? Why is he on that tier up there with the likes of Ali?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one thing about Jim Brown is that he has attempted to stay politically relevant and be true to what he believes politically for 55 years. I mean, 60 years, really. And, you know, it's hard to think of anybody else in public life who first made their political impact in the mid-1950s, and they're still with us in 2021. Now, we may disagree and even strongly disagree with what his political activism has been in recent years, namely cozying up to Donald Trump and Kanye West. But in Jim Brown's mind, he has been remarkably consistent for that entire 60, 65 year stretch. Because in his mind, what he's been fighting for is economic self-determination for the Black community. And so, and for him, the method for how to get there is completely like the wild, wild west. Like, however you get there is fine. So Donald Trump was making promises. Okay, I'm going to talk to Donald Trump. You know, in the 1960s, he started the Black Economic Unions, which were incredibly ahead of their time, in which he partnered up local Black-owned businesses with local athletes in different cities. It was actually a brilliant concept. Mm-hmm. And in addition, funded scholarships to business schools for Black youth. Unfortunately, it didn't last past the mid-1960s, largely because the movement itself wasn't looking at that kind of political action, but was looking more towards, you know, mass protest and revolutionary confrontation with white supremacy, and not looking so much to the work of trying to seed businesses and, you know, get your piece of the pie in capitalism. It's like that old argument of, do you want a bigger piece of the pie or do you want your own bakery?
Right.
And, you know, Jim Brown was definitely going for a bigger piece of the capitalist pie, while the movement itself was saying, we're going to try to get the bakery. But that didn't stop Jim Brown from being seen as this kind of revolutionary figure. You know, what I find so interesting about Jim Brown, and you might have to stop me, William, because I could go on and on and on, because I think it's just so interesting. What I find so interesting about Jim Brown is that, you know, from his beginnings also, he had another point of consistency of Jim Brown from the 1950s to the Trump days, is that he always had an antipathy and a hostility towards protest and towards the civil rights movement of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right.
Because he just didn't believe that that was going to be effective. He described civil rights marches as parades,
right,
in the 1950s and 60s. And then he did the same thing when he was in a verbal conflict with the late John Lewis back in 2016, mm-hmm, when John Lewis said he would not recognize the legitimacy of Trump's election. Jim Brown got on CNN and made those same critiques about John Lewis being part of parades, but not real action. And I remember seeing that. And of course, I disagree with that very strongly. But I marveled at the consistency of Jim Brown, that, you know, this man really has not changed in his perspective. He once said, if I ever march, I'm going to march alone. But that being said, I find it very fascinating that he was one of the few people to get a personal invite from Coretta King to Dr. King's funeral.
Right, right.
I mean, that's amazing to me. So he was, and that's because he was seen as such this figure of towering strength and manhood in the face of a society that was trying to tear Black people, particularly Black men, down, that his image and his representation really was bigger than what his politics might have been,
mm-hmm,
just because he was Jim freaking Brown.
Right. Dave, that's one of the more interesting things I discovered in your book, because I'm 36 years old, so I wasn't really familiar with his journey. So when I first saw him with Donald Trump, I thought, wow, how could one of our Black activists stand next to Donald Trump, a president many people think is racist and xenophobic and homophobic? But in the book, it seems as if these have consistently been Jim Brown's thoughts. He's not really about integration. In the book, he talked about integration makes it seem like all we want to do is stay up under white people. He was more about rights and Black folk having the ability to kind of build their own and economic freedom.
Yeah.
Is that a form of activism? What is it out of bounds to see him stay along the sides or be alongside Donald Trump?
I mean, I think it was a terrible error by Jim Brown, just like I think it was a terrible error for him to, you know, be on the side of Richard Nixon in 1968. You know, so that wasn't new for Jim Brown to stand alongside Trump, because he's always had a lot of suspicion towards the Democratic Party, understandable suspicion towards the Democratic Party, and been much more for, you know, the Malcolm X approach of, I'd rather you try to stab me in the front than stab me in the back.
Right.
But he certainly has not followed the Malcolm X approach when Malcolm said, you know, when it comes to political parties, I'm for neither the jackass nor the elephant. You know, that right, has not been Jim Brown's approach. Jim Brown's approach has been much more, who's going to give me a better deal, the mm-hmm jackass or the elephant, and who's going to give my people a better deal? And so we forget that Richard, and I write about this in the book, that Richard Nixon was talking about Black power in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was adopting the phrase for very opportunistic reasons, and Richard Nixon was a racist in and of himself. But for Jim Brown, that was part and parcel with his brand of activism. Because his brand of activism, as you said, was all about economic self-determination and fighting for which political party, which political leader is going to get him a bigger and his people a bigger piece of the pie. And so his consistency is remarkable, but I think he took a tremendous hit to his personal reputation when he said, you know what, Donald Trump is the way forward for Black America.
I want to talk about a few things that took place in his career, some moments that I thought were really impactful. For one, he was the first athlete to negotiate a contract using an agent.
Yeah, that's right.
How big of a deal was that? How foreign was that at that point in time?
Huge. And, you know, if he was anybody other than Jim Brown, you know, a star player at Syracuse, somebody who I believe was MVP his rookie year in the NFL, and somebody who just clearly from the first time he stepped on a football field was bigger, faster, and stronger. I mean, he was the LeBron. I mean, that's why maybe LeBron feels this closeness to him, not just the Ohio connection, but the fact of, you know, maybe there are three people in the history of men's sports who come to mind to me, and they're Jim Brown, Bo Jackson, and LeBron James, people who just look like they're bigger, stronger, and faster than everybody they're competing against. You know, I mean, it's like somebody like Lawrence Taylor, who was my hero growing up, linebacker for the Giants. He was amazing, but he was like going against linemen who were 50 pounds bigger than he was. Jim Brown was bigger than the linebackers he was running over. I mean, he was like somebody taken out of the future and brought backwards to play in a league that was not ready for him. And so because of that, it gave him leverage. I say that big preamble about his playing ability because I think it's important to understand how good he was. Because if he was anybody less than that, he would have walked into the general manager's office and said, "This is my agent." And they would have said, "Wow, that's very interesting. Well, you're cut.
Wow.
You know, you're done. We don't work with agents, you know." But because he was Jim Brown, they had to deal with him on that level. And he also was somebody who, as I write in the book, it was not uncommon for him to walk into the general manager's office when they would cut a player that he really liked and say, "This will not happen." You know, get him back on this team. And I tell the story of a friend of his, Walter Beach, who Jim Brown saved his job on the team. And Walter Beach went up to him afterwards and said, "Wow, thank you, Jim. You're a friend for life." And Jim Brown said, "Shoot, I didn't do that because you're my friend. I did that because you can play ball and you were being unfairly cut. You know, friendship doesn't mean anything when it comes to me doing that." And because Jim Brown did that, it's so funny. The other general managers, or the owner of the team, they used to call Jim Brown the locker room lawyer. And it says something about how they viewed players at the time, that that statement was a statement of insult.
Right.
Like, you are a locker room lawyer. And when, you know, instead Jim Brown took that as a point of pride. He's like, "Yeah, you're damn right. I'm going to advocate for people in this locker room." But they didn't see players that way from the management perspective, particularly the Black athlete, my goodness. And so for him to be seen as a locker room lawyer, it just said something about his stature. And then, of course, he did the ultimate. This is one of the reasons why I think he was seen as this incredible revolutionary figure, even though his politics might have been less than revolutionary and more rooted in the history of economic self-determination that you see in people like Booker T. Washington, et cetera. But one of the reasons why is because then when Jim Brown, before his 30th birthday, just walked away from the league.
Right.
I think the NFL would have liked nothing more than for Jim Brown to play until age like 35, 36, have his body broken down. And then they get to do to him what the NFL loves doing to outspoken athletes, is say, "Yeah, well, you're now used up," yep, and kick him out the door. They would have loved to have done that. Like, so long, locker room lawyer. Now, but he really had the last laugh.
You spoke about him walking away from the game. And again, me just being an outside observer, 36 years old. The story to me was always he left the game because there was more money in music, in movies. But reading your book, it seems like he had designs on coming back to the game, but he was threatened by the then owner of the Cleveland Browns. So he decided to walk away. What can you tell us about what took place between him and owner Art Modell?
I mean, I just, this is why one writes books, you know, because to correct history in a lot of respect. Yes. Because I certainly grew up as a huge football fan, and I'm way too young to have seen Jim Brown play. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with the idea that you just described, that he left football because he got a chance to star in the Dirty Dozen. Mm-hmm. And he was like, wow, this is going to be my future. And that's not what happened at all. He was filming the Dirty Dozen during the off season, mm-hmm. but then terrible weather on the set meant that Jim Brown would have to miss training camp. I mean, give me a break. We're talking about, at the time, the reigning NFL MVP, just 1 year off the team winning the championship. That's the last championship the Browns have won since then, 1964. Mm-hmm. And there Jim Brown is, just saying, I'm going to have to miss training camp to finish this movie, which I'm contractually obligated to do. And Art Modell gave him like a small fine, said like, for every day you miss training camp, this is how much money you're going to be charged. And Jim Brown took that as an affront to his, as he put it himself, to his manhood.
Yep.
See, with Jim Brown, it always comes back to manhood. That's why I called the book Last Man Standing. It's because for him, it's that's where it's at. Whether he's in Hollywood, whether he's playing sports, whether it's in his relationships with women, certainly, whether it's how he's worked with gangs, it always comes back to this question of manhood. And so when Art Modell was, as he felt, questioning his manhood, treating him as somebody who is something less than a full human being, he walked away from the NFL. And when he did that, the shockwaves it sent, I mean, there are no words for it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it took till Barry Sanders, 30 years later, mm-hmm. to see an NFL player walk away instead of limp away from the sport. You've seen that a lot more in recent years, yep. as players have been more educated about concussions and things of that nature. But until Jim Brown, no one had ever walked away. And then you have somebody like Barry Sanders walking away. I mean, it just says something about how, I think, frankly, addictive playing in the NFL is for a lot of players.
Yes.
And how difficult it is for them to imagine a life outside the league. Mm-hmm. And for Jim Brown, he was able to imagine and envision a life for himself. And that made him a powerful and, in the eyes of the movement, a revolutionary figure.
Indeed. Indeed. One last piece on this book, Dave. Jim Brown is kind of critical of today's athlete. I think he feels that they are beneficiaries of a lot of sacrifice from those who came before them. And today's athlete is not really willing to pay it forward and make the same sacrifices. And there was one piece in the book when he says, you can take the money, but when you take the money, you become a front man for kind of like the system, right? And then your own culture dies.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, I thought this was phenomenal. I never heard an athlete of this caliber speak like that. And when I look at today's athlete, every message they send to us is sponsored by Walmart or Coca-Cola or something. So it's really the system that is speaking to us. So the black athlete doesn't have a voice anymore.
Right. I mean, it's like, it's not, you know, it's all athletes at this point in history are basically corporations with legs.
Right.
And they're corporate entities, they're brands, they are influencers. And that's why, you know, to me, it's like we have to treasure the athletes who try to stand on their own as a man and not as a brand, or as a woman and not as a brand, mm-hmm. because it is very rare in this hyper corporatized sports world to see an athlete risk commerce for a broader political principle. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was remarkable, for example, after the police murder of George Floyd, like how many athletes were willing to step up and speak out. But then what you saw was very interesting was then the leagues tried to catch up to that, mm-hmm. and, you know, put branding on the court and branding on their uniforms, and in the NFL, branding in the end zone to be like, oh, we're on the side of the players here. But now that it's the next year and that's died down a little bit, you now see a lot of that stuff being taken away because the leagues have decided that it's outlived their usefulness and that they're alienating white fans. So for Jim Brown to say what he said, you see, and this is what with Jim Brown, like, I agree with you. When I read that, my mind was blown, like, whoa, that's amazing. Yeah. And I my personal feeling is that with Jim Brown, when I look at his entire life, there is a gap between what he had the potential to be and then where it actually ended up, like in that Oval Office with Donald Trump. Like, but at the same time, some of what he could have been was inhibited structurally. Like when he went to Hollywood,
right,
there was a ceiling put on his head as a black man of how high he could go. Mm-hmm. He tried to start his own production company with Richard Pryor. You know, that didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so he was thwarted many times in terms of reaching the heights that he really could have reached. But my goodness, the mind he had and has is just remarkable. I think he was also thwarted by his relationships with women and the abuse that would take place in those relationships. And he spoke about it, like about how his relationships with women would trip him up when he was trying to do other things. Because as I argue in the book, like, he just had a lot of issues that date back towards childhood, mm-hmm, that he was never really able to work through.
The issues with women is something that I was unfamiliar with. You don't really see it much or hear about it much. How come you think Jim Brown has been able to kind of skate by even with domestic violence cases and issues in his past?
Because I think he's been able to skate by precisely because he is so iconic. And he did it in an era where a lot of that was seen and not discussed,
yes,
or ignored. And so, you know, years go by and people look backwards and they're conflicting accounts. It becomes a lot harder to have a true reckoning about his history, even in this Me Too age where you see when people are abusive towards women. I mean, it's probably going to about to take down the governor of the state of New York as we're having this conversation.
Yep.
And it's just it has to do with the era in which Jim Brown came up. And it's complicated because what you'd like to see more than anything else is for Jim Brown to face it and to speak about it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's ever, ever, ever going to happen.
Right. All right, man. That book was great. Thank you for that. Very fascinating and interesting individual. Jim Brown, Last Man Standing by Dave Zirin. Ladies and gentlemen, I went in search of a history lesson. I wanted to learn firsthand about the great Jim Brown, and I got everything I was looking for. I wanted to know why he is so revered, why they make movies about his era and his time and his contribution. And I got everything I was looking for. First and foremost, Jim Brown was the first NFL player ever to show up with an agent. Hey, NFL. Hey, Cleveland Browns. I'm not just taking whatever you're giving me. You got to negotiate with my agent. Wow. You see, Brown knew that he was one of the best. So he used that stature, that muscle, to apply pressure to the system of white supremacy, to make them uncomfortable, to help wrestle back some of the power that they have over us. Ladies and gentlemen, those are the acts of a revolutionary player. Those are the acts of a revolutionary individual. Blazing a new trail, not asking permission. I don't see the equivalent of that today. I don't see any of these players willing to make the establishment uncomfortable. No, too many of them are trying to yuck it up with their owners, trying to get on Jerry Jones' yacht to sip mint juleps. That class of athlete that Jim Brown is, like, no longer exists. Too many people are trying to get along with the system instead of dismantling it, instead of applying pressure and making it uncomfortable. another piece to Jim Brown's story. He was about economic self-determination. He was about the freedom to control his own business. And in a book, he gets disillusioned with the civil rights movement. He says, yo, this sounds like we just begging to be up under some white folk. That ain't what we want. I don't want to sit at some lunch counter with somebody that wants to spit on me and curse at me. No, all I want is the ability to create my own path. And Jim Brown is not the only person from that era to be disillusioned with civil rights. Bill Russell was as well. And when I think about it, it makes perfect sense. All that I want is the freedom to create. I don't want yours. I don't want his. I want my own. I want a path without resistance, without any impediments. That's what Jim Brown was fighting for, which is different than civil rights. And I know a lot of people were up in arms when they saw Jim Brown with Donald Trump. But you see me, I don't let my ego get in the way. When I see somebody that's been celebrated for 40 plus years and then they make a move that may not be popular, I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. What I do is I humble myself and truly examine why. Why is this taking place? Right? What can I learn from here? And Jim Brown sitting with Donald Trump, yo, if this is the guy that's going to help put things in place that my people could take advantage of, well, hell, I'm going to sit at the table with him. And you people up in arms, oh, Trump is a racist and this and that. Yo, Trump ain't the problem. He's a byproduct of the problem. He's a result of the problem. The real issue is the system of white supremacy. Right? And I mentioned many a times, I got frustrated when all of these athletes, LeBron included, tried to act as if Donald Trump was the only issue. When they do that, it distracts you from the fact that your favorite athlete, your favorite rapper is actually contributing to what the real issue is, which is the system of white supremacy. It distracts you. What they're doing is actually exploiting you. Kamala Harris did it. Joe Biden did it. Yeah, man, that Donald Trump, we got to get him out of here. Donald Trump done came and gone. How your life done changed? It hasn't. So stop being distracted from where the real issues lie. Another piece. And it was always explained to me, and I'm sure many of my peers, that Jim Brown left the NFL because there was more money in Hollywood. False. Jim Brown was planning on returning to the NFL. He was somewhere shooting a movie, and the filming ran late. So he was going to show up late to training camp. The owner of the Cleveland Browns, Art Modell, said, Jimmy, I'm going to find you. Jim Brown said, no, you're not. Middle finger to you. I'm not your little boy, right? The threats are an affront to my manhood. So Jim Brown walked away. Dog, when I read this, I almost jumped off of my couch. Jim Brown said, yo, there's something more important than your money, and it is my manhood, my self-respect. So he gave the league a middle finger. It wasn't because, oh, that was more money in movies. No, Jim Brown struggled in film. There were limited roles for blacks. He ain't a movie star. He left because he was threatened. And Jim Brown don't abide by that. That's a man of principle. That athlete doesn't exist today. Look no further than LeBron James. When he left Cleveland the first time to go to Miami, his owner, Dan Gilbert, wrote a scathing letter about the star, basically calling him soft, a quitter, a loser, said he was weak. People liken that letter to a slave master commenting on a runaway slave. How did LeBron James respond? oh, he returned to Dan Gilbert's franchise a few years later and helped to fill the coffers of Dan Gilbert. A stark contrast from how Jim Brown handled it. No. Different, man. I've been telling y'all for a long time, today's athletes are weak. Today's athletes are more occupied with getting along with the system than dismantling it. I hate to break it to you, but your favorite athlete is actually a product of white supremacy, is an agent of that oppressive system. They're built up, they're marketed by the enemy. And that's okay, because we all have to play the game to some degree. But when you have this position, what do you do to turn around and apply pressure? Nothing. Jim Brown showed up with an agent. With all of these superstars we have in the NBA, NFL, there's less black coaches today than there were a few years ago. And general managers, they're losing ground. And that leads to my next piece on Jim Brown. He is really disillusioned with today's athlete. He feels they have benefited a great deal from sacrifices made by athletes that came before them. Athletes made a lot of contributions to help build these leagues up to where they are. And he feels today's athlete does nothing to advance the movement. You know, they showed up in these leagues, are healthy financially, and these athletes take the pot of gold, get fat, and do nothing. There was a piece in a book where Jim Brown says, yo, you can take the money as an athlete. You can take the money. You can be a pitch man for a company. But what happens is, ultimately, when you take the money, you become a front man for the person that's supplying the funds. So that's not LeBron James speaking to you. That's actually Phil Knight and Nike's voice. That's not LeBron James, that's Walmart or McDonald's or T-Mobile or Sprint or whatever corporation is hiring these guys. It's the system's voice. It's not that athlete's. Jim Brown said that. He said you could take the money, but you become a front man, and ultimately your own culture dies. I said, damn, this was pretty profound, because I've always believed that. And now here's one of the greatest saying it. You remember that speech years ago where at the ESPYs it was LeBron James, it was Chris Paul, it was Carmelo and D-Wade, and they got so much respect for what they said. Yo, ESPN made them rewrite that, confirmed. So it wasn't their voice, it was ESPN's. I want to let you in on a conversation I was having with my guy Fenton. I don't know if you guys saw this video recently. It was Kevin Durant and Draymond Green sitting down to discuss the issues they had at Golden State. I didn't watch it because I think it's a bunch of bullshit, but it's not my type of content. But I know there's an audience for that. Two prominent players, KD, Draymond Green. And they took that content to Bleacher Report, which is one of the mainstream sports outlets. And I thought, damn, here's two prominent athletes with influence, with followers, with a story and content that I know the people are going to respond to, and they choose to bring it to one of the mainstream outlets. The same mainstream outlet that these athletes always talk about and claim these reporters and things don't know anything about what it's like to be an athlete or don't know anything about sports. I said, damn, here you have an opportunity to create your own stuff and you take it to them? So I text that to my man, Fan. I said, yo, Fan, these boys love running to the white folk platform. And And let's see what Fenton's response was. Fenton said, let me see if I get it. He said, Will, blah, 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 blah. That was his response. No, but in all seriousness, he said, yo, Will, it's about the money. Bleacher Report has the followers and the outlets, and they could pay them the biggest bag. I said, Fent, I hear you, bro, but there are things that are more important than money. He's talking, Will, what are you talking about, son? It's about the bag. It's about the bag. He said, if it's not about the bag, then what's the goal? I said, Fent, I don't even have the stomach to entertain this money conversation with you right now. I'm not doing it. He said, he kept texting me, yo, Will, what's the goal? I said, yo, Fent, I'm not having this conversation. I said, you know what? Thank you for that question, because I'll bring it to my podcast. I'll answer it there. So, to my beloved brother of 25 plus years, if it's not about the bags, what is the goal? And my answer to that is simple. The goal is survival. That's it. The goal is survival. No different than any other creature on God's green earth. The lions, the tigers, the bears, the birds you see in the sky, my two beloved French bulldogs that I have at home. It's about survival. Now, the system of white supremacy wants you to believe that securing the bag and survival are synonymous, are one and the same. They're not. Chasing after the bag always has you under their thumb, under their control, desiring their acceptance, which allows them to manipulate you, control you. That's what the bag does. Going back to Jim Brown, economic self-determination, that's what he was after. That's what our people should be after, the ability to create their own, not get on that platform. There's nothing stopping any of these athletes from creating their own media outlet. There's nothing stopping these athletes from creating their own shoes. But the white folks have no problem throwing a bag at you, because then they could control you. So you ask me, what's more important in the bag? Self-respect, survival. These are the things that are going to contribute to a healthy life. You know, and I would ask you, black people have more money than ever before in history. We got more money than ever before. Why does it seem like our communities are turned upside down? Why does it seem like when we open our doors in our communities, it's worse than ever before if it's about the bag? What good is a bag when they control your name, image, and likeness? You look at us on TV, they're masculinizing our women, they're feminizing our men, turning the black family structure upside down. How are we going to ever build a functioning community when the images you see on TV are crazy? You see the Lil Nas X, they got that nigga fucking pregnant. Dog, be gay if you want, more power to you, but pregnant? A male? Turning our youth upside down. All for a bag. What good is a bag when they control what is put in our children's head? You got folks sitting on the boards of these colleges and these schools controlling the curriculum and stuff like that. That's dangerous. Malcolm X said, only a fool would let an enemy raise his child. All for a bag. There are things more important: self-respect, education, knowledge of self. I'll tell you a story. And I hope my brother-in-law is listening. I like following my nieces on social media because for them and for a lot of people, social media is like a diary. People say things that they won't say in public. Like it's their innermost thoughts, and it's easy for them to share it because they don't actually have to speak with somebody face to face. They don't have to actually talk. They could just type something. So I was on my youngest niece's social media, and it was a meme, and the top of the meme read, "Hey, nobody is perfect." And then there was a picture of a white woman, and then at the bottom of the picture, it said, "Hold on, wait a minute, I take that back." So essentially, what the meme is highlighting is that, or at least the way she put it together, this is the image of someone she thinks is perfect. Baby girl, this is what you think is perfect, but we can't blame her because the system, they control the images and the names and the likeness, and everywhere you look, that is the image of beauty. So Fenton, what good is a bag if they have a whole system of white supremacy apparatus that has our wives, our mothers, our sisters, our nieces thinking less than themselves? Tinkering with their self-respect and their belief in self. So yes, there's something greater than the bag. We got all the money in the world as black people, but we don't have one community in this whole great nation, not one that we can call our own. When I think back to the olden days of black Harlem, where we owned the cabs and the restaurants and the liquor store and the bootleg casino, like that sounds like magic, son. That sounds beautiful. Like I desire to be there. That community, it helps feed your soul. People was walking around feeling good about themselves. The goal is survival. It's not a bag at all cost. Furthermore, the bag. There is a rap group out of Buffalo, New York called Griselda. These dudes are supposed to be the hardest out. It's Benny the Butcher. It's West Side Gunn. It's Conway the Machine. If you ever seen Conway, his face, half of his face is paralyzed because he was shot. You know? And in today's era, that makes people gangster because they got shot. Again, I'm from the early 90s. I rock with Hov. We respect the shooter. But okay, gangster. Not too long ago, Conway the Machine was pictured in a skirt. And when asked about this, he said, "Yo, you know I secured the bag. This is some Alexander McQueen shit." Ladies and gentlemen, when did the bag become justification for doing any and everything? I grew up in an era where we used to say, "Yo, dog, all money ain't good money." No different than how we used to say about women, "All ain't good." This is a family show, so I won't finish that line. But you get what I'm saying. All money ain't good money. I ain't heard that saying in a while. But Conway felt so comfortable. "Yo, dog, you know I got a bag for that." As if that's justification for doing anything. So now you got one of the most gangsterous rappers, supposedly. Legions and legions of followers. This is what our youth are going to aspire to be. Again, feminizing our men. Distorting the image of the black men. All for a bag. That turns our communities upside down. And motherfuckers want to talk about, well, you know, in Ireland, they wear kilts. They sure do. If you ever been to a military funeral, when someone passed, there's a guy that comes out in a kilt with bagpipes, and man, it's not a dry eye in this space. Kilts are for warriors of Ireland. Absolutely. But motherfucker, are you Irish? Y'all doing anything for a bag, and it's turning our community upside down. And the system of white supremacy is not concerned with a bag. If you ever been in any of these corporations, and I've been at some of the biggest, especially in sport. You guys know that. The conversation isn't about money. The conversation is about control. The conversation is about minimizing you. Yeah, you know, if we operate in this space, then we'll dominate. We control the image, the likeness. We could turn them people upside down without chains, without whips. They want you to chase after the bag. They want you to be a hamster in a wheel. There are things more important in the bag, and that is being lost. Freedom, survival, self-respect. Because with that, you can do anything. You can build your own community. You don't need a bag. You know this, Fent. You can have all the money in the world, but you still can't get a reservation at that restaurant. Why? You ain't got a functioning community, right? They put you in a position where you're going to always need them. That's not what I'm after. I hope that ain't what I'm after. I'll tell you a story. We got books in here. I think I got the Jordan rules right here over my right shoulder. Michael Jordan was MVP of the league. He was the champion. So in the offseason, you know Mike likes to play golf. He reaches out to a local golf course. Hey, Michael Jordan's ready to pull up and become a member of your golf club. The golf club said, nah, Mike can't be a member. He could play whenever he wants. We'll clear the day for him. But he can't be a member of this club. He's a black man. The great Michael Jordan. They got institutions that are in place to secure their survival. The white folk ain't after a bag. They know the conversation needs to be about survival. They trick you into thinking it's about a fucking bag. What else did I want to get off my chest? Michael Jordan at the golf club. When I was in the doctorate program at East Tennessee State University, we traveled to Germany. And they took us to this town square, like a big open plaza. And there was a little hole cut into the ground. It was like a glass, and you can look under, and it was like empty bookshelves. It was a landmark that highlighted when Adolf Hitler burned 20,000 books. 20,000 non-German books. He burned them. And I thought this was very significant because here you have one of the most ruthless men in history who are putting people in concentration camps. In the midst of all of this chaos and destruction, he found it necessary to secure literature and burn it. Why? Because he knows when people have knowledge of self, when people have self-respect, like any access they have, the material that can help strengthen their mind, well, that's a dangerous person. They can uprise. So he made sure he burned that literature and took a step to control what people consumed. That's what the system is doing to us. They're putting us in a weakened state so that we're always dependent upon them. And I'm sad to have to report this to you, but your favorite athlete is complicit in this. They're a sanitized version of Black America. right? They've been co-opted by the system, by the apparatus, and being fed back to us to make us believe that they're on our side. Now, don't get it twisted. LeBron James, the young black man from Akron, Ohio, who is a product of a single-parent home, who missed 100-plus days of fifth grade, like, that's my brother. The international, world-renowned athlete, he was given to you by the system. Two different people. I have some other stuff, man. I can't. I hope y'all don't mind me taking my time. So I'm trying to remember it all. Chasing the bag and survival is not the same thing. Okay? You talk about the bag. How is the bag most important when there's a man at the Federal Reserve who decides how valuable your bag even is? Hey, man, black folks is catching up. Let's raise the interest rate. Or what? They too broke. We need them back out in the workforce. We need them buying stuff. Let's lower the interest rate. It ain't about a bag, my people. It's not. My brother, Fenton, he recited some literature to me as well. He said, Will, ain't that what they say in the 48 laws of power? And I forget which law he recited. The 48 laws, man, that's the devil's work. This is written by people that have been in place to control us. They write a book on how they control us, and they send it back to us. And we look at it like it's the gospel. To all of my people, my black folk, if you want to recite literature to me, if we ain't talk about the message to the black man by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, if we ain't talk about from niggas to gods by Akil, that lay out exactly what this whole system and apparatus truly is about, don't recite any literature to me. And honestly, if that is too pious and sacred and theological for you, you know, people got different religious beliefs, and that may be too extreme. I know when you mentioned Honorable Elijah Muhammad, people running hot. If you want to talk about literature, to all of my black folks, if you ain't read the Willie Lynch letter, don't recite any material to me. For those who may not know, the Willie Lynch letter is about some guy, some British slave owner, Willie Lynch, who came to Virginia in 1712, and he was speaking to his brethren, fellow slave owners, and he was like, yo, dog, this is the blueprint to how you control these people. It's not about whips and chains. No, that doesn't work. Control their mind. Take their mind, leave the body. I believe that was in the letter. Some of the tactics they use, have them black folks fighting against each other about any differences they may have. Age, sex, light skin versus dark skin. Take away their voice. That's how they do. There's no airways where a black person can go on and speak the truth. Just go back to July 4th. Fox was going to air Minister Louis Farrakhan's speech. Then they said, nah. Why do you think that is? Because he's a black man they can't control, and that's dangerous. Y'all playing the wrong game out there, man. And Jim Brown. Yes, I got all of this from Jim Brown. Exposed it. All right? Nothing you see on TV is real. All of that stuff is controlled by a handful of people. I don't know if you guys know, recently they changed Aunt Jemima's name on the syrup bottle. They feel like it was offensive. Aunt Jemima, right? Okay, cool. Aunt Jemima was changed. Give me a second. Give me a second. Okay, Aunt Jemima's name was changed. The most significant thing about that change is when Quaker Oats issued the statement and said, yo, we're going to change the name. I said, damn, Quaker Oats own Aunt Jemima? Quaker Oats? Everything you see on TV is owned by just a small group of people. And I'm looking right here. Quaker Oats is owned by PepsiCo. That's what it was. When Aunt Jemima changed its name from Aunt Jemima to Pearl Milling Company, PepsiCo released a statement. I said, damn, Pepsi owns Aunt Jemima? That's two different fields. You don't even have soda with your pancakes in the morning. Why? Because this world is only owned by a small handful of people. And that's who's controlling everything. And they're not talking about money. They're talking about suppressing you. And minimizing you. While you're distracted with a bag, they're more concerned with annihilating your people. They're more concerned with killing you. All right, I ranted enough, man. Ladies and gentlemen, what good is a bag if you don't have one neighborhood in this country to live in, one safe neighborhood in this country to live in, right? In the inner cities, in the ghettos, in the slums, trash. And being poor doesn't mean your neighborhood needs to be unsafe. I was reading some work by the great Thomas Sowell, and he said early on in Harlem in the projects, people would sleep outside if they didn't have an AC. That's the type of communities they had. They took care of each other. Even though we broke, you ain't got an AC. People would sleep on a bench and you were safe. You ain't have to worry about anything. But nowadays, our own communities are not safe. So if you get some money, you got to go live in the white folks' neighborhood where they don't want you, where they going to stare at you, where they going to call the cops on you, where they don't want their kids playing with your kids. So it ain't about a bag. It's about self-respect. It's about survival. Okay? LeBron James knows that firsthand. He got all that money, and he had to go live in their neighborhood. Didn't they spray paint nigga on that boy's garage? All the money in the world can't protect him from that because there's something greater than the bag. The white folks have a whole apparatus system that contributes to their survival. We don't. Motherfuckers too worried about concerning themselves with white folks' trinkets. Oh, I made it. Oh, my God. I'm enough. Enough. Hopefully, I made my point. So to answer my brother's question, the goal is survival. Mm-hmm. You can have all the money in the world. You don't even have doctors you could trust. You don't have a hospital you can go in and trust that they're going to take care of you. No facilities, no resources. And if it's about money, why do people like Mayor Bloomberg and Mitt Romney risk half their damn net worth to go get a government position that pays pennies? Why? Because it's about access. It's about resources. They know that. They know that. I'm no longer entertaining conversations about the bag. I know too much. Sorry. I'm way too informed. Personalize it. Ladies and gentlemen, y'all know me for a long time. I do what I want. You know what I'm saying? Like, I done had some money. But you never see me out here running around, throwing it around. Why? Because what I'm after is a system that can sustain me and protect me. That is what I'm after. And when I get that, that's when I made it. That's why not only do I do this podcast, but I'm in the streets with them young high schoolers because I'm trying to help to change their minds because all I need is a community. I got more than enough money. Love y'all. Dave, let's talk about your newest project coming out September 14th, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. What can you tell us about this book?
Well, first of all, it's not about Colin Kaepernick, okay, which might surprise some people. I mean, the introduction is because I think what Colin Kaepernick did was create a language for a generation of athletes who saw themselves being radicalized by the Black Lives Matter movement to speak out, to use the athletic space as a place to talk about social justice. And what Colin Kaepernick did was he provided this language for those athletes to say, wait a minute, the playing field is a place for me. The playing field is a platform for me. And one of the things I argue in the book is that you can't understand how this country was able to produce in 2020 the largest protests in the history of the United States after the police murder of George Floyd without understanding that one of the important bridges that got us to that point was the bridge between 2016, when Colin took that knee, to hundreds, if not thousands, of young athletes at the high school, junior high school, and even collegiate level who took a knee. And what I did was I interviewed dozens and dozens of athletes. That's the book.
Okay.
Is that I wrote it during the pandemic, and I took advantage of the fact that a lot of these young folks were at home.
Right.
Remember those early days, nobody's leaving the house.
Right.
And I spent like over like a month and a half, 2 months on the phone every day, just tracking people down and talking to them. It's interesting. We talked early on about how difficult it is to write a book because of the isolation. This was the most fun I've ever had writing a book.
Excellent.
Because it involved talking to people every day.
Who are some of the interviews? Who are some of the individuals you were able to interview?
Well, the famous ones is I would talk to Megan Rapinoe from USA Soccer. I talked to Colin's former teammate, Eric Reed. I talked to Olympic hammer thrower, Gwen Berry. But the main thing is I spoke to people who none of your listeners would have heard of.
Right.
Is just like people. And what was so crazy about it was I spoke to people from Seattle, Washington and Beaumont, Texas. Mm. I spoke to people from upstate New York and Nebraska. I spoke to people from Florida and California. Like, we're talking very different parts of the United States. And it was very interesting teasing out the commonalities and the differences based on where they were coming from.
Excellent.
And the number one difference, of course, has to do with politics and where they were when they took that knee. Because my goodness, if you're in some like right-wing area or red state, the amount of backlash these young people received was more than a lot of folks could have ever dealt with. And they deserve a great deal of respect for putting it all on the line, putting their personal safety on the line. They got death threats. Yeah. I mean, all kinds of things they had to deal with. But the commonality that existed between all these folks is that they didn't take a knee during the national anthem as a way to show solidarity with Colin Kaepernick. It wasn't about Colin Kaepernick. Mm-hmm. For them, they did it much more because of Trayvon Martin than Colin Kaepernick.
Right.
Colin Kaepernick just provided a language for them to do it.
Indeed.
And that's the other thing I discovered talking to folks from Ferguson, Missouri and New Jersey and, my goodness, Oklahoma. What I discovered was that for all of them, and this was something I didn't understand given my age and given that I'm white, I didn't understand, like, Trayvon Martin for them was like Emmett Till for the civil rights movement. Like, it was like, for imagine if you're 19 years old now. Mm-hmm. That means Trayvon Martin is killed when you're like 10.
Yep.
And for them, being 10 years old, seeing Trayvon Martin basically stalked and killed and no justice coming as a result was such a searing, scarring experience for them that they carried it with them to high school.
Gotcha.
And when they started hearing about other killings, people like Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, it just pushed them to do it. But for all of them, and I'm not even exaggerating, for all of them, Trayvon Martin lurked in their mind as they went about this process. And that was something I learned doing the book.
Wow. Wow. What do you remember about the first time you learned what Kaepernick was doing with this protest?
Well, it was so funny. I mean, I learned it the day it happened because, you know, this is what I do in terms of sports and politics. This is what I've been covering since 2003. Mm-hmm. So I was like, whoa. The first thing that surprised me was that it was Colin Kaepernick. Because Colin Kaepernick was never somebody who was particularly outspoken in his career.
Right.
I mean, early on with the 49ers, if you remember, he was a lightning rod because he was a black quarterback with tattoos, yep, kissed biceps in the end zone. Mm-hmm. So he was on the receiving end of a lot of racist BS from the media.
Right.
But he was never somebody who was speaking out like the way LeBron had, for example, or the way the women of the WNBA had. And then to hear that it was Colin Kaepernick who was first not taking a knee, but sitting during the anthem, I was like, whoa, wow, that's a real surprise to me. Mm-hmm. And doing the book, I learned that when he sat like that, he didn't tell anybody. Oh. It wasn't something where he was trying to get publicity. It was only because a reporter for the NFL Network who I interviewed named Steve Weish saw what Colin was doing and went up to him and said, yo, what was that about? Mm-hmm. And that's when Colin just uncorked about police getting away with murder and there being no accountability and that he's tired of seeing it. And this was just weeks after the police killings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling.
Right.
And remember, that came out on videotape and the whole world saw it that summer. And remember, and Colin first sits in the preseason, which is August.
Yes.
So it's still that summer of 2016. And it just blew people's minds when Colin said all the reasons why he was doing it. It connected with people.
Yes.
And doing it during the anthem, of course, summons up names like John Carlos and Tommy Smith and Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf and this whole tradition of athletes who've used the space of the anthem to speak about the gap between what this country promises and then the lived reality of too many people.
Yes. When I first learned about it, I thought it was amazing. You know, a silent protest that spoke volumes. And I enjoyed being able to tell the world as both a black man and a veteran that I agreed with him taking a knee. Dave, did Kaepernick make any mistakes after his protests following, I guess, once he had the world's attention?
I mean, I'm always hesitant to judge how other people approach protests.
Right.
Colin Kaepernick has made the choice to largely be silent.
Yes.
In the years since his protest. And I think for folks who've been involved in the movement, I mean, think about all the people who took a knee during the protests of 2020. And I write about that in the book, how it became this symbol. And even in some cities, police took a knee in front of the protesters to show that they were sympathetic to what was happening, which, you know, we can have a whole discussion about what that's about. But it was very interesting that that everybody saw that gesture as the gesture of a movement. And he's chosen to be silent and let that year of 2016, where he did it, you know, before every single game, speak for itself. And that's been his choice, is to sort of be a little bit of a cipher and a symbol, as opposed to being somebody who's outwardly speaking and trying to encourage people to get involved and be part of the struggle. Now, I think it's great that he's putting out a book that deals with issues of police and prison abolition that he's editing.
Right.
So, you know, he's it's almost like he's staying involved in the way in which he's comfortable.
Yeah. That's
and allowing what he was to be a symbol. Like, you know, I've met Kaepernick. I mean, he's just not the type of person who is going to be standing in front of a crowd of 20,000 people doing some badass speech. He's much more comfortable being like behind the scenes and letting his silence speak for itself. And that's his choice. And all I can do is respect that choice, even though I can also say, quite frankly, that perhaps other folks would have done it differently.
Right, for sure. And it's like you said, he was kind of like an unlikely character that emerged. You know, when the movement hits you, it hits you. And as you said, he's probably conducting himself in a way that's most comfortable to him.
Comfortable for him. Right now. You know, there's the famous line, I'm going to get it wrong, but famous line from Shakespeare where it says, some people are born great and some people have greatness thrust upon them. Yes. And he's definitely someone who had greatness thrust upon him. Like he took that seat because he personally was frustrated with police violence. He had no expectation that he would become this international symbol of protest and racial justice. And, you know, it must have overwhelmed him to a profound extreme.
I'm sure. Dave Zirin, I look forward to picking that one up. I want to tell you, sir, thank you for your work. I'm a fan and a supporter. It's hard to go out there and kind of knock on doors and ruffle feathers for a living, man. But it's necessary, giving voice to the voiceless, exposing those evildoers. Like that is necessary, noble and honorable work, and I'm behind you, brother.
Thank you. That means a lot to me to hear you say, because yeah, it is lonely work, and part of it being lonely is you don't hear people say a lot of the times what you just said to me. Mm-hmm. So I really do appreciate it.
All right, brother. Take care. Yo, thanks again to Dave Zirin. Greatly appreciate him sharing his time. And I meant what I said towards the end of that interview where I just thanked him for his work. Because without investigative journalists, we'd be in trouble. The system, these rotten scoundrels, would be getting away with a lot more. It is the work of investigative journalists willing to knock on doors, ruffle feathers, and expose truths that helps to save lives. When I think of America and its freedoms and liberties, especially as it is compared to other nations, if I wanted to highlight one institution that represents those freedoms, I would point to journalism. Because you think in some nations, North Korea, China, Russia, when people speak out, they end up disappearing. They show up dead. So the fact that we even have a media that can go out and criticize the president, that can go out and expose companies that are dumping oil in the water and things of that nature, that's special, man. And if it wasn't for guys like Dave Zirin, we would be in a lot more trouble. Just think about it. Any cause that is near and dear to your heart, you're probably aware of it because of the media, because someone chose to write about it, because someone chose to uncover it. You know, unless you're a marine biologist and you actually dive into the bottom of the ocean and you come up and say, yo, dog, we need to take care of the ocean and save the world. Or unless you were actually in Sanford, Florida, in that gated community when a vigilante murdered Trayvon Martin. You only know of that because of the work of individuals like Dave Zirin and people of his ilk. So salute to him and everybody that does that work, man. We need it. That was episode 72. I'm William Holly's WBH Radio. Out.